This is SciPod, the podcast of New Scientist magazine.
Find out what's new?
Oceanography,
astronomy,
medicine,
botany,
physics,
evolution,
cosmology,
ecology,
information technology,
genetics,
biotechnology,
mathematics.
Welcome to SciPod, the weekly podcast of New Scientist magazine, and your audio guide to the latest news in science and technology. Hello, I'm Bill Oxley. This week on the February 17th edition of SciPod, getting mad and getting even. If there's an angry elephant after you, it might not be your fault. It could be something your brother did to his brother. Where the river meets the sea. Scientists take a close look at the world's river deltas and get a sinking feeling. And from foamy space to long-legged toads to King Tut's Chardonnay, we'll uncork this week's science news. But first, when it comes to humans, it's no surprise that elephants have a lot to complain about. We encroach on their habitat, we separate them from their families, and all too often, we kill them for their ivory. But now it seems elephants have had enough. Recent studies suggest that elephant aggression is on the rise both in Africa and Asia. And now some scientists say the motive could be revenge. Dr. Joyce Poole is research director with the Amboseli Elephant Research Project. This week, Ivan Semenek caught up with Dr. Poole at her base camp in Amboseli National Park in Kenya.
Hi, Dr. Poole.
Hi there.
Dr. Poole, could you fill in the picture for us a little bit? What kind of behavior, what kinds of incidents would constitute elephant aggression as you've seen it?
Well, if in the area that I work, Amboseli National Park, elephant aggression may be in the form of killing livestock or killing or injuring people. For instance, last year there was an elephant who killed an elderly man early in the morning. As it happens, that man was walking in the dark, came upon a sleeping elephant, became obviously very alarmed and upset when this man bumped into him. But he ended up being killed, which caused a great uproar in the community. And in the end, he had to be shot, which was very sad for everyone, I think.
I think it's easy to imagine that startling a large wild animal and catching it by surprise would be a dangerous thing to do that could have serious consequences. But are some of these conflicts more than that? It sounds as though elephants could also, in a sense, seek out being in conflict with humans.
Yeah, not necessarily seeking out, but some of this negative interactions between elephants and humans have been going on for centuries. And so in a way, it's a sort of a culture within on both sides to, let's say, hate one another or be aggressive toward one another. The Maasai see the elephants as being a dangerous animal, and the elephants see the Maasai as being basically a predator. On top of that, the elephants associate the Maasai livestock in the same category. So they take their aggression out sometimes on livestock, which of course then makes Maasai angry. So there is a very much a sort of culture of violence that has built up and is passed on from generation to generation on both sides.
I'm interested in this idea that the elephants would then go after the livestock, or perhaps maybe there are cases where they would go after people. What do you think is going on with the elephants there? Is it plausible that they're trying to exact some kind of revenge on humans that they perceive to be a problem?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I do think elephants are smart enough to feel revenge. I mean, we've seen that in the case of captive elephants where individual keepers have abused elephants. Those keepers have gone away for many years and have come back, and the elephants have gone for them. So there's no doubt that elephants recognize people individually, that they remember those individuals and they remember how they've been treated, and will take revenge.
So does that suggest then that the elephant population that you're familiar with is changing over time as they're increasingly coming into contact with humans? Is their attitude towards humans changing?
You know, we work quite hard in Amboseli to reduce that conflict and reduce the bad feeling between people and elephants. We've set up what we call a consolation scheme, where if elephants are found to have killed a cow or a sheep or goat, we will then pay for that individual. And the idea behind this is people are only paid if they don't retaliate and then spear an elephant. So we're trying to break that cycle. But is it increasing? I think in areas where elephants and people are coming into more and more conflict, let's face it, the human population is growing very rapidly over much of the elephant range in both Asia and in Africa. So an elephant numbers are dwindling, but at the same time, the actual interactions, number of interactions between people and elephants are increasing, and many of those interactions are negative. So yes, the numbers, the instances of aggression are increasing because they're smart, they understand that people are aggressive toward them.
Tell me how you think that should be informing the way elephants are managed.
Well, I think it's really important. If we're thinking long-term and thinking about reducing conflict, we really have to sort of cut this cycle of violence, reduce the number of elephants who are being shot, who are being speared, who are being poisoned, chased out of farms in a way where they feel, of course you have to chase them out of farms, but in a way where elephants aren't being injured. We have to reduce the amount of negative interactions between people and elephants. Very often here in Kenya, if a person is killed by an elephant, the Wildlife Service is in a way forced by public pressure to go out and shoot an elephant, any elephant, for sort of revenge to satisfy the public. But my feeling is that this only exacerbates the situation, makes the elephants more aggressive, because you pass the violence to yet another family. So wherever we can, reduce the shooting on control, reduce the spearing and our own violence toward elephants. Now, that's not an easy, there's no easy answers in this. And of course, as people, there are more and more people, hungry people, the conflict will escalate. I think we have to think about it in the same way we think about aggression between human populations, different cultures, different religions. How do we reduce that? And I think really think along the same line.
Now, Dr. Poole, I can imagine a skeptic saying that some of this sounds too much like ascribing human emotions and motives to another species. Is that a question you have to grapple with as a scientist, or do you think we should be opening our eyes to the fact that perhaps we have more in common with elephants than we might have thought?
Oh, I used to have to grapple with it a lot, and I must say that attitudes are changing so fast toward the concept of animal emotions and animal personalities and a lot of the, basically, the basic similarities between us and other animals. And I really don't have that sort of difficulty anymore. Yes, one has to be careful and be aware of what we're saying, but I think on the basis of all the work that we've done here in Amboseli, we feel quite confident in speaking the way we do.
Well, thank you, Dr. Poole, for leading us through this fascinating topic. We wish you well with your efforts to help the elephants.
Thank you very much. They certainly need it, and they need people's sympathy and understanding all over the world. Thanks.
Dr. Joyce Poole spoke to us from her research camp at the foot of Mount Kilimanjaro. She's with the Amboseli Elephant Research Project, and she's one of the researchers featured in Elephant Wars, a story in this week's edition of New Scientist.
SciPod, giving you audio updates in science and technology news as gathered and written by the staff of New Scientist magazine.
Now here's Donna Page and Jeff Whittle with this week's science news.
To the human eye, empty space looks like, well, empty space. But now some scientists suspect that when space is viewed through the world's most powerful telescopes, it might show itself for what it really is, a seething, fluctuating quantum foam. According to the rules of quantum physics, at extremely small scales, roughly 10 trillion trillion times smaller than an atom, space itself ceases to be smooth and instead resembles a bubbling froth in which particles are spontaneously created and destroyed. As difficult as this may be to imagine, it's been even harder to imagine how anyone might go about proving the quantum nature of space. But now, cosmologists at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill think they've found a way to do it. The team reasons that light has to bend and swerve as it moves through the froth of space, not unlike a car maneuvering over a road full of potholes. When viewed over great distances, this effect should accumulate, turning the crisp image of a faraway galaxy into a fuzzy halo. The effect is so slight that until now, no telescope has been able to observe it. But the cosmologists say an instrument now being built at the European Southern Observatory in Chile could detect the effects of foamy space in just a few years' time. Donna?
A new discovery may push back the age of the Sahara Desert by millions of years and could link its origins to a major shift in Earth's climate. The discovery comes in the form of petrified sand dunes, which were uncovered in Chad. French researchers found that the ancient sand dunes were buried under another deposit that formed during a wet interval. That deposit includes fossils from animals that lived several million years ago, which suggests the petrified dunes are older than that. 7 million years ago roughly corresponds to the time when a land bridge began forming between North and South America. It's thought that the emergence of this land bridge cut off ocean currents and shifted the Earth's climate into a colder, drier mode. The new discovery suggests that same shift brought about the Sahara. Until now, the oldest evidence for a desert in this area only dates back around 86,000 years. Jeff?
And speaking of the sands of time, it seems that King Tutankhamun, the teenage pharaoh of ancient Egypt, headed off to the afterlife with a good supply of white wine. Scientists at the University of Barcelona in Spain analyzed the residue from 6 jars that were found in King Tut's tomb. The residue contains tartaric acid, which is a byproduct of all winemaking grapes. But only one of the jars contains syringic acid, which is a marker for red grapes and wine only, and that suggests that 5 out of the 6 jars were full of white wine, and that pushes back the first record of white wine in Egypt by about 3,000 years.
And finally, as if an infestation of giant poisonous toads wasn't enough, how about toads that evolve and grow as they spread into new territory? That's exactly what Australians appear to be facing as cane toads continue to move outward from Queensland, where they were first introduced in 1935 to control pests. Since then, the toads have become pests themselves. And lately, biologists have noticed a curious effect. Toads that are at the leading edge of the infestation have legs that are about 10% longer relative to their bodies than the legs of the average cane toad. A toad with longer legs can jump farther and move into unoccupied habitat faster than other toads. This selective advantage means that tall toads are more likely to find other tall toads to breed with, an effect that is magnified with each successive generation. Scientists estimate that the rate the toads are growing, they'll have their own basketball team by 2048.
We hope you're enjoying this edition of SciPod, and we would love to know what you think of our podcast. If you'd like to share your thoughts with us, please complete our short podcast survey. It's easy. Just visit newscientist.com/podcast and follow the links to get the survey. And now, back to our show. Months before Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, the Big Easy was already on a list of the world's most dangerous river deltas. Given rising sea levels and the fact that deltas have a tendency to sink, that may not be a big surprise. What is alarming is that New Orleans is far from unique, and that many similar or worse disasters could be in store for people who live anywhere near where a river flows into the ocean. Those deadly deltas are the subject of a newly available study by Jason Erickson. He did the study while he was a graduate student at the University of New Hampshire. He's now a project manager with the Virginia Department of Conservation and Recreation, where he spoke with Ivan Semenek.
Mr. Erickson, New Orleans is vulnerable, at least in part, because it sits on the Mississippi River Delta. Your study seems to suggest there are many more New Orleans around the world just waiting to happen.
There are. There's a number of large cities on the deltas that we looked in our study, including Shanghai, Bangkok, Cairo, Cartagena, and, of course, New Orleans.
And these, of course, are not just uninhabited corners of the world. These are densely populated regions. How many people live on deltas? How many people could be affected the way New Orleans was?
There's really a very large number. About 4.6% of the global population lives in these 40 deltas that we looked at. So we're talking about hundreds of millions of people.
I guess any coastline is vulnerable to storms or to the effects of rising sea levels. Is there something about river deltas that makes them more so?
There is. Their existence really depends on an interaction between land-based sources and coastal sources. So they're there because sediment's being delivered as rivers make their way towards the ocean. And so they're susceptible to to issues with the delivery of sediment to the deltas, the compaction of that sediment, which is called subsidence, as well as sea level rise and coastal erosion.
So I guess it's the thing that makes the delta so vulnerable that also is what attracts, or historically has attracted people to live there.
Absolutely. They tend to be fertile. A lot of alluvial sediment delivered by rivers. And there tend to be petroleum deposits in some deltas. So that's also brought economic and population impacts.
So tell us more about what motivated your study. What were you looking for?
Well, we were looking for, we kind of identified this issue as something that needs to be addressed because there are deltas in all sorts of economically diverse areas, also climatically diverse areas. And it's something that's not just associated with one region of the world, it's associated globally. And it really is a very complex issue. There's, like I said, there's things dealing with the amount of sediment that's getting to the deltas, what's going on within the deltas as far as petroleum being extracted and groundwater being extracted, and then kind of that overbearing issue of sea level rise, which we hear so much about.
So could you take us through a potential scenario or sort of an area that we should be concerned about, say Shanghai or Cairo? How might a future disaster play out in these cities?
Well, Shanghai, I'll look at Shanghai. Shanghai is susceptible to typhoons. And so, with a typhoon like we saw in New Orleans, there's going to be a storm surge, which is basically water that's pushed up. And, over time, as, we're seeing the deltas subside, because in Shanghai they're pulling a lot of groundwater out for agriculture and for human consumption. They're also a large number of dams upstream that's reducing the amount of sediment getting downstream. And if we, if you combine that with sea level rise, we're seeing, a pretty significant increase in what the delta sees as sea level. So you add that to the storm surge, and you're seeing a very significant amount of folks that could be impacted by a storm like that. In the Shanghai Delta, it's about 8 million additional people would be affected in a storm surge situation because of this effect of sea level rise if we looked at it over a 50-year period.
Now, there are a number of different factors playing in there. Sea level rise, I guess, is linked to global warming, which is, an entire world issue, not something in particular that maybe one city can do something about. But then, as you say, because of dams, because of the manipulation of the water flow, the amount of sediment that's delivered to a delta is also changing. Can you tease those factors apart for us? What plays a bigger role? Is it all wrapped up together?
A big part of our study was really kind of get at that issue. And we looked at, like I said, 40 deltas, and we found out through our methods that about 27 of those, the biggest impact is sediment delivery. So if you look at the total amount of sea level change that we're seeing in a delta, the biggest portion of that for 27 of the deltas was sediment delivery. Like I said, things like dams, and there's other issues that we didn't look at, but other issues restricting sediment delivery, such as levees, which is an issue in the Mississippi Delta. Accelerated subsidence related to groundwater withdrawals and petroleum withdrawals was the major issue in 8 of our deltas, and sea level rise was an issue in only 5 of them, or the major issue.
So if you're a political leader in one of these locations and you're looking at how susceptible your region is to flooding, to subsidence, what can be done about it?
Well, I think basically what this is telling us is that we need to focus a lot on some of these land-based issues and not just the sea level rise issue. We need to address the fact that a lot of these deltas are subsiding due to extraction of groundwater and oil, and that they're seeing less sediment. And I don't pretend to have the answer, but I think we need to focus a lot of our energies on that, and maybe not quite as much as on the sea level issue itself.
And just to get back to where we started, New Orleans isn't free and clear of this, is it?
I don't think so. Just because it happened once doesn't mean a storm can't happen again. And in the Mississippi Delta in particular, there's levees along a good portion of that, and those are built to stop flooding. But what they also stop is sediment being deposited on the delta and really allowing that delta to keep growing or to keep at where it is. And so, there's a balance there between what the Delta wants to do and what we need to do to have people live there.
Now, not to be too dark about this, but I guess if this is a balance that's been difficult for the United States to strike, how much harder would it be for a developing nation that really needs the wealth that comes out of these river deltas?
I think it's very hard. If you look at a delta like the Bengal Delta in Bangladesh, there's a very large population living at that delta, and there's been storm surges in the 1970s and the 1990s that have killed upwards of hundreds of thousands of people. I think the sheer number of folks is because they live in, they can't protect their cities the way we can as far as things like embankments, levees, and storm walls. And they're very susceptible to storm surges.
Well, thanks, Mr. Erickson. Let's hope your study gets to those who would benefit from this information.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Jason Erickson spoke to us from Richmond, Virginia. His study on the world's most dangerous deltas is the subject of a special news report in this week's edition of New Scientist magazine.
Subscribe to New Scientist magazine, and every week you'll enjoy a comprehensive roundup of the latest science and technology news, along with a listing of the best science jobs from around the world. Subscribe today and you'll save 40% off our annual price and get unlimited free access to the entire content of newscientist.com. To take advantage of this offer, just visit www.newscientist.com/2504. That's newscientist.com/2504 for the week's best ideas delivered right to your door.
Well, that just about wraps up this week's edition of SciPod, but it's only the beginning of what you can find in the February 18th edition of New Scientist magazine. Also in this week's issue, Snooze Control. A new generation of drugs is about to give us unprecedented power over sleep. But are we ready to boot Mother Nature out of our beds? Watch that wobble. What the peculiar wanderings of the North Pole can tell us about Earth's mysterious core. And flying high on the high seas. A new technology promises to speed up ocean transport by letting ships slide across the water on a carpet of bubbles. All this plus lots more science and technology, news, features, and opinion. Remember, only New Scientist brings you the week's best ideas. I'm Bill Oxley. Join us next week and find out what's new on SciPod.
Mission control. Transmission concluded.